And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, Warren has dropped out of the race. And, of course, Rachel Maddow claims it's misogyny. Mere fact the voters didn't like her is, that's not an issue, it's misogyny. Well, last night we started talking about some of the secrets of World War II. There's a lot of information that's out there, but we've never been told. For example, the war killed a lot more people than commonly reported. The death toll is estimated to be around 100 million. But the number of people who were killed in or died as a consequence of World War II can't be determined with any absolute degree of accuracy due to political considerations. Traditional estimates range from a low of 30 million to a high of 55 million, but you know, with a little bit of research and available information, you can get to a figure of over 80 million very easily. Now, the figures established by some countries are not complete. For example, generally published figures for civilian deaths in Hungary are about 200,000. But 90% of Hungary's 400,000 Jews vanished into Hitler's death camps. Civilian deaths in the Soviet Union are actually higher than previously reported, though according to recently published documents from what had been secret Soviet archives. And then there's the problem of losses in the Third World. With millions of civilians who starved to death in India and Indochina as a consequence of a global shipping disruption aren't listed as victims of the war, but they most certainly were. And there are also deaths, although small number, due to military operations in Iran and Iraq, as well as from accidental air attacks on Switzerland and Sweden, as well as among neutral merchant seamen. And the figures that have been released don't include people in many countries killed during industrial accidents because of the increased workload for the war effort. Over 300,000 Americans alone died in such mishaps during the war, and the majority of them were war-related. And then there are the people who died after the war, often long after, from the lingering effects of wounds or deprivation, and from the civil disorders, insurrections, and anti-colonial revolutions that came about because of the war. So it's not unreasonable to say that in excess of 100 million people died as a result of World War II. That was about 5% of the planet's population at the time. Now, the Allied total military deaths was about 15 million, give or take. Civilian casualties, allies, of course, about 50 million. And then we're looking at between the two totals, over 66 million right there. Now, the on the German side, or the Axis, I guess we should say, which at various times included Bulgaria, Finland, Germany, Hungary, Italy, Japan, Korea, and Romania. We're talking 6 million military, almost 5 million civilian. So you add the two sides together and you got 80 million right there. That's just deaths per country specifically related to the war. And that's just within the countries themselves. We're not talking about what may have happened in their territories. And that's just the known casualties. Now, World War II was notable for the large number of civilians who were killed. Many of these were, I guess you could call them normal deaths of civilians caught up in the fighting. And others were deliberate actions by nations to destroy civilian populations. Sometimes the population was attacked to try to defeat the military. Most notable of these were the Nazi programs to kill populations they considered subhuman, such as Jews and Slavs and Gypsies, etc. And some nations suffered more than others. Several lost more civilians than they did soldiers. Now, the increasingly harsh conditions that Hitler's Germany imposed on the Jewish population through the 30s convinced them that the coming war would be particularly hard for them. While the Nazi extermination program was run ruthlessly, efficiently, and deceptively, not all Jews went along with the deportations to the labor camps. Many fought back and fought with unbelievable courage. Outnumbered, outgunned, and they still fought. Now, some Jews were organized into regular military units like the Jewish Battalion that fought alongside the British in North Africa during 1942. And caught in an exposed position during a German offensive in June of 1942, this unit came as close as a unit can to fighting to the last man. By the end of July 1942, about 45 of the battalion's initial 1,000 troops were still alive. Eventually, a Jewish brigade went on to fight in Italy and demonstrated unbelievable courage. Now, equally grim losses were sustained by the Jewish partisan units formed in Poland and Russia in 1941 and up through the end of 44. And although about 6 million were murdered by the Nazis in the camps, this represented only about 90% of the Jews that the Germans tried to kill. The rest escaped. And while some tried to lie low till the war was over, many of the escapees joined the resistance in whatever country they wound up in. And survival rate of these fighters was very low, and that was known in the beginning. Less than half lived to see the end of the war. In many guerrilla units, less than 10% survived. The harsh winters they spent in the forest of Eastern Europe are often more lethal than the Nazis. Now, the Germans didn't consider partisan soldiers, and when they took any prisoner, they shot him. No trial, no nothing. That wasn't the only problem. And while the Jewish battalion and later the Jewish brigade was trained and many Jewish World War I veterans retained military skills, most of the partisans were young and inexperienced. And guerrilla warfare was quite different from the combat regular soldiers are accustomed to. Guerrillas, for example, had to kill informants to prevent the German secret police from finding the guerrilla hideouts or catching sympathizers in towns and villages. And although many Jewish resistance fighters served in all Jewish units, they had to depend on the local people for support. And most of the locals were not Jewish. So if word got around that one of the villagers was passing information to the Germans, a few guerrillas would pay a visit on the informer under the cover of darkness, and with no other alternative, they'd kill him. But even this grim business had what you might call a lighter side. One young and green Jewish partisan operated in the Lvov area during 1943 was sent with a more experienced fighter to kill an informant in a nearby village. Sneaking up to the house of the informer in the middle of the night, the older man looked at the younger man and nodded toward the door of the informer's house. And the younger man, a city boy, walked up to the door and knocked. The older partisan looked on in disbelief and whispered, "You don't knock, you break it down." And he demonstrated by breaking in the door with the butt of his rifle. Well, the door crashed open. They rushed in. Shots were heard, and The two partisans were seen running for the woods. The Germans, for their part, took no prisoners when they were fighting the partisans. And the partisans didn't take any prisoners when they fought the Germans. It was a war with no quarter. And three of the major participants in World War II, Germany, Russia, and Japan, began the war with an attitude that attacking all the time was the key to victory. But they had a curious omission in their bag of battle tricks. None of these nations bothered to teach its troops how to effectively retreat. In fact, in many cases, Hitler ordered his units to do a dip. Die in place. Don't retreat. Going into war, these countries were so dedicated to attacking that the troops were at a loss in situations where retreat was the more productive course of action. Now, the Soviets were the first to learn this particular lesson. When the Germans invaded the Soviet Union in June of 1941, the Soviet troops they confronted hadn't been trained to retreat effectively. And this meant that Russian troops faced with an overwhelming attack literally fell apart. What might have been a tenacious rearguard action turned into a rout. German advance might have been slowed to a crawl if the Russians had practiced the stubborn delaying tactics they later adopted. But in 1941, their lack of defensive training was effectively lethal for the Russians. Of course, the Germans soon got their own lesson in defensive warfare. When their advance stalled in front of Moscow and all along the Russian front in late 41, the Russians gathered up whatever reserves they could and launched a counteroffensive. German combat training at that time paid little attention to defensive operations, and so the Germans had to improvise. And even though the Russian counteroffensive was hastily put together, it was winter, and the Russians knew how to effectively use the weather as an ally. The Germans didn't. The combination of weather favoring the Russians and the Germans' lack of training and defensive operations made the Soviet attack a success. If the Germans had been as effective defending as they were attacking, they might have won on the Eastern Front. And even as it was a close-run thing. The Germans and the Russians went on to develop their own novel techniques for defending and retreating. The Russians would often strip most of their front line, which was over 1,000 miles generally, of all but a thin line of units, which were given meager supplies of ammunition and food. And these troops would be well entrenched, and there'd be several lines of fortifications for the troops to fall back to if attacked. And then they'd concentrate as many troops as they could in a place or places for a massive offensive. Germans reacted to this by developing the risky gambit of carefully observing the Russian preparations. As good as the Russians were at deception and camouflage, they were rarely able to hide the preparations for one of their big operations. And the Germans knew the Russians weren't flexible enough to change their plans at the last moment. So just before the Russians began their enormous artillery barrages, the Germans would move their troops out of their positions to another line of fixed defense further back. So the Russians wasted a lot of ammunition, and the Soviet troops would have to slog through the shot-up terrain till they bumped into that second line of untouched German fortifications. Russian losses in these attacks, even if they eventually won, were enormous. Now, the Germans usually lost these battles anyway, but the technique slowed the Russians and prolonged the war 1, maybe 2 years. And more than the Russians and the Germans, the Japanese didn't think much of defensive tactics, and they did very little training. When in doubt, a Japanese commander would launch a straight-ahead charge with drawn sword and shouts of banzai. Well, this made life easier for Allied troops in the long run, though the frequent desperate Japanese assaults were always unnerving. But these banzai charges were rarely successful. Japanese never really came to grip with the concept of retreating, though they did develop formidable defensive bastions on the islands they suspected the Allies would invade. And they were good at redeploying or evacuating troops from islands where they didn't think they could succeed. But both of these measures were seen as merely preliminaries for future offensives, which never materialized in most cases. Unless you consider the desperate charges by the last survivors of some island garrisons in attack, the Japanese have been as effective in retreating and reorganizing as they were in attacking. The war in the Pacific would have lasted a lot longer than it did. Now, World War II was the first conflict in which a substantial number of deaths were inflicted by aircraft. And in some cases, the numbers inflicted were enormous. Now, nobody was keeping records, but at least several million and more civilian and military deaths can be attributed directly to air attacks. In addition, the British suffered 2,754 deaths from ballistic missiles, that's the V-2s, a record that stood until the 1980s when Iraq and Iran rained Scud missiles, which were based on the V-2 design, on each other's cities. In those exchanges of missiles, over 10,000 died. Great Britain also suffered 6,184 deaths from German V-1 cruise missiles, which is still a record. Japan, from air raids, lost 668,000 people, Germany 593,000 people, and Great Britain 60,400. And that's a lot of people. Now, more firepower was used in World War II than any other conflict in history. And since the heaviest fighting was in the heavily populated areas, one of the big losses, aside from civilians themselves, were homes. Most of the homes were centuries old. I mean, some of the ones in Russia were absolute palaces. And often the loss of a family's home led to some of the residents dying of exposure. Well, there were certain countries that had an unbelievably high destruction of private homes. Soviet Union had 3 million destroyed. Japan, 2,251,900. Poland, 516,000. Great Britain, 456,000. France, 255,500. Germany, 255,000. The Netherlands, 82,530. Now, the figure for the Soviet Union of 3 million is a conservative estimate. The other nations actually kept track of the destruction. And for every home destroyed, there were 2 to 4 or more damaged to some extent. In Japan, which had 2,251,900 destroyed, they had as many as 10 million damaged because of the highly flammable nature of their construction material and the use of firebombs. A lot of them, a large part of the homes were light wood or paper. Naturally, there was equal, if not more, destruction to businesses and government structures. Now, not all of this was from aircraft attack, of course. There were tanks and artillery that generally tore up the landscape and anything that was built on it. One advantage the U.S. Army had in ground combat was its innovative methods of controlling and coordinating artillery fire. Now, this wasn't really an accident. Throughout the 30s, American gunners improved their equipment techniques to the point where the U.S. had the most effective artillery in the world. And this success that a lot of the other countries envied came from because of several reasons. We designed new guns after World War I and had them ready for mass production when World War II began. The standard 105mm howitzer was based on a German gun of the same caliber used in World War I. But our version was a much improved version. And the guns of other calibers were of equally high quality. Then the decision was made to dispense entirely with horse-drawn guns, something most armies didn't do until well after World War II. We immediately arranged for our artillery to be towed by trucks or to be self-propelled, kind of like a tank. But it didn't have armor and a turret, of course. And one thing the Germans discovered, you can't get a horse to wear a gas mask. If it can't breathe, it's going to lay down. And if it lays down, the artillery it's towing stops. Then our biggest breakthrough was in fire control. We had a combination of advanced computing techniques, mechanical computers, of course, and lavish use of radios, which gave us the ability to be more flexible than the other nations. In the past, for most of the nations during World War II, guns were aimed and fired according to a carefully prepared plan. Now, if the enemy operated according to your expectations, this would work. But this was not often the case. Forward observers had been used since World War I, but in that war they'd call back instructions for only a few guns, usually a battery of 4 to 6 guns or a battalion of 12 to 18 guns. Our innovation was to allow the forward observers to call upon the fire of all the guns within range. And U.S. artillery units practice this constantly, and this enabled our fire to be concentrated quickly, accurately, and massively. I've got some experience operating as a forward observer. And one of the things they did during our infantry officer training basic course, we sat in a bunker downrange where you had rounds coming in literally on top of us to see how effective artillery fire would be. Then, being in a manufacturing giant, we had millions of tons of artillery ammunition produced and rapidly sent to the guns at the front, using equally numerous military trucks that we turned out. Not only was the ammunition abundant, it was of high quality. Then artillery units had their own single-engine aircraft, usually Piper Cubs, to carry forward observers over the battlefield. In these heights, targets could be spotted and the fire adjusted. In fact, in an emergency, even fighter pilots could be used as forward observers to call on artillery fire. To the enemy, our artillery seemed to be everywhere, all the time in an unbelievable quantity. And should they launch an attack, every American gun within range would, as if by magic, begin firing on the advancing troops. That could ruin your afternoon, to be perfectly frank. The result was both the Japanese and the Germans were surprised and usually pulverized when they encountered the artillery support that accompanied most U.S. ground units. Germans thought this was somewhat unfair, if only because we had it and they didn't, and the Japanese found it just another way to die with some nobility. One of the little-known activities of the U.S. Army during World War II was its extensive use of opinion surveys. While the Army was being mobilized, several senior officers came up with the idea of collecting many of the professional sociologists and statisticians and put them in a separate unit that would regularly survey the troops to get their attitude. As a result, hundreds of surveys were taken of troops undergoing training in the U.S. and later on while they were in combat. After the war, Samuel Stouffer and several of his colleagues, all veterans of wartime survey duty, published most of the resulting material in a 2-volume set called The American Soldier. Surveys revealed a great many things, some humorous, some tragic, some were both, and some of the findings were all that shocking. Enlisted men and officers had different, sometimes vastly different, attitudes about how effective or well-run their units were. Men who'd seen combat wished their training had been more strenuous. Soldiers actually wanted more discipline and, in general, stronger leadership from their NCOs and officers. And the troops were very astute in sizing up the effectiveness of their NCOs and officers. Combat veterans quickly sorted out the ins and outs of surviving on the battlefield, more so than the people in charge of training new recruits back in the U.S. And veterans from the Pacific Theater said that combat became more frightening as time went on, while those from the European Theater said it tended to become less so. Although, under any circumstances, it was scary. One of the surveys of American combat veterans who'd fought in North Africa indicated the average infantryman had a restricted and somewhat inaccurate view of what was trying to kill him. Now, this was the first time U.S. troops came up against the Germans. When asked what the most feared weapon was. 48% of the troop survey said it was the German 88mm artillery gun. When asked what was the most dangerous weapon, 62% said the 88. Now, the Germans very rarely used the 88mm gun as artillery. It was primarily for anti-aircraft, anti-tank work. In these roles, the 88 had acquired a fearsome reputation, and these U.S. troops assumed any time they were hit by German shell fire, it was from the very dangerous 88. But they did have the percentages right. Artillery is a major cause of casualties among the infantry. Next most dangerous thing, according to 17% of those surveyed, was the mortar, followed by the deadly German light machine guns to 6%. Interestingly enough, none of the troops feared rifle fire, considered it especially dangerous. And this was also an accurate view. The most dangerous weapons are actually artillery, and these accounted for over two-thirds of all casualties. And these surveys were used by senior officers to set policy. But they were also ignored by other officers who had their only firmly held victim visions of reality. Surveys were taken, however, one of the remarkable innovations of World War II, and even today, surveys are used. You know, it was common in wars for troops to arrange local truces and cease fires with their opponents. Sometimes this occurs between nations when there are several countries on each side of a conflict. And this was the case in World War II when in August of 1943, Hungary and Great Britain reached an understanding Allied aircraft flying over Hungary would not be fired upon because they were going to bomb targets in other countries. In return, the Axis wouldn't bomb Hungary. Now, Hungary was always an uneasy ally of the Germans. The Hungarian troops had taken an awful beating on the Russian front the previous year. This particular agreement was hammered out by British and Hungarian diplomats stationed in Turkey. When the Germans found out, they were not amused, to say the least. So they took control of Hungary in March of 1944, and the agreement ended as the Germans are now in charge of the anti-aircraft guns. A year after Britain entered World War II, the national suicide rate had gone down 15%. By 1941, it was down 30% from its 1939 levels. By 1942, it was down two-thirds of the pre-war rate, and when it stayed there until the end of the war. Now, after peace broke out, suicide rates picked up. Same pattern was observed for divorces, which fell sharply during the war, but rose substantially after the fighting ended and the troops came home. Nobody's really sure why these trends appeared to be true, but they were. Now, approximately 95% of the casualties during World War I were military personnel, meaning 5% being civilians. In World War II, the casualties were 33% soldiers to 67% civilians. Now, only once in nearly a century has bean soup not appeared on the menu of the Senate dining room in the Capitol. In Washington on September 14, 1943, as a result of wartime shortages, the supply of white Michigan beans ran low. The ensuing senatorial uproar was sufficient to ensure there were beans enough the next day and on every subsequent day after that. As today, senators and congressmen expect special treatment. In all nations, it was common for the senior leadership to avoid suffering the shortages most of their followers were enduring. On the other hand, American civilians suffered least of any nation's civilians in the war. While there was rationing of clothing, meat, shoes, and a number of other items, it was largely a cheerfully borne inconvenience, except in the matter of gasoline, which hurt the national romance with automobiles, was the most resented and most evaded restriction. You know, human nature and media being what they are, it's not surprising people have a tendency to come up with theories about conspiracies and treachery and cover-ups and other nefarious Machiavellian plottings, particularly in cases where unpleasant things occurred. World War II certainly had its share. You know, one of the most discussed was the Pearl Harbor plot. Now, this is the ultimate World War II conspiracy theory. It says that Roosevelt and other national political and military leaders knew the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor, or even convinced or connived at arranging the attack in order to get the United States into the war and save Great Britain from being defeated. Now, there are variations on this theme, a lot of them, including an interesting one contending that Winston Churchill knew and refused to tell Roosevelt. Unfortunately, when all the information is examined, particularly the periodic new evidence, the most charitable thing to be said of the charges is they're not proven, but then again, they haven't been disproven. Some of the proof advanced in support of the conspiracy theories falls into the category of, I saw Elvis on a UFO, such as the charge it was actually British airmen who conducted the attack from a secret air base on one of the other Hawaiian islands. The disaster at Pearl Harbor was a result of a lot of audacity and luck on the part of the Japanese and numerous blunders by many American political and military leaders. Nobody appeared to be particularly criminal in what took place. As one historian said, there's enough blame for everybody. Don't need to be piggish and try to get more than your share. Then we have the Slapton Sands cover-up. On the night of April 27, 1944, nine German motor torpedo boats, they're called E-boats, attacked one of the convoys participating in a landing exercise off the Devon coast of England. They sank two LSTs and severely damaged another while killing over 700 American soldiers and sailors. Now, the Supreme Allied Headquarters promptly put a lid on the incident, classified it as secret. Now, in theory, this was done because the Germans might be able to determine from the extent of the exercise the imminence of the Allied invasion, which was scheduled for early May. And Devon is closer to Normandy than to the Pas-de-Calais, where the Allies wanted the Germans to think the invasion would take place. And they wanted them to think the Pas-de-Calais was the probable objective. Well, D-Day came and went, with the units that had been at Slapton Sands suffering fewer casualties on June 6th than they had on April 27th. From time to time, various newspapers, writers, and television producers looking for some sensationalism have discovered evidence of a massive cover-up concerning the incident. There's even a locally built monument to the cover-up that serves as a tourist attraction. In actuality, the military's position's always been there was no cover-up. Information about Slapton Sands was declassified shortly after the war, and the incident was mentioned in numerous works of history, including the Army's official history of the Normandy operation published in 1951. By that time, nobody was particularly interested in what had taken place. But certainly, the lid was put on the release of any information about it. And then there's what's called the Mount Suribachi conspiracy. And it's maybe the most enduring image to come out of the war, and it's Associated Press photographer Joe Rosenthal shot of five Marines and a Navy medical corpsman raising Old Glory on top of Iwo Jima's Mount Suribachi on February 23, 1945. Now, this was actually the second flag raising that morning. A platoon of 40 men from the 28th Marines had reached the summit after fierce hand-to-hand fighting, and at 10:20 a.m., three of the men raised a small American flag on a piece of pipe. Realizing the flag was too small to be seen readily and wanted to ensure the regiment retained the original flag, the officer in charge sent for a larger one. Shortly after that, the battle ensign of LST-779 was brought up, fastened to a longer piece of pipe, and raised to the cheers of many of the troops hotly fighting with the enemy. And it was this flag raising that was photographed by Rosenthal. Now, lately it's been claimed this second flag raising was deliberately staged as a photo op by the Marine brass to garner more prestige for the Corps and ultimately a bigger share of the post-war budget. Actually, the entire episode was unplanned. Both flag raisings were made by the Marines on the spot, several of whom didn't even survive the subsequent combat. And the fact that there were two flag raisings can be found in all detailed histories of the battle. And both flags are prominently displayed in the Marine Corps Museum with photographs of both flag raisings. Rosenthal's just happened to be the artistically better of the two. Interestingly enough, several of the survivors of the flag raising are still alive, but none appear to have been consulted in the matter by those making the charges of photo opportunity. Excuse me. Then there's the betrayal of Market Garden. Operation Market Garden, also known as the Bridge Too Far attack, resulted in the decimation of British and Polish airborne forces in Arnhem when they dropped almost literally on top of two crack SS panzer divisions. It was frankly one of the greatest disasters of the war. And rumors have long circulated the operation was betrayed by German sympathizers in the Dutch resistance. Actually, the Dutch underground hadn't been informed about the operation because there were fears it had been penetrated by German intelligence. In fact, if the Germans had heeded information they got from the Dutch resistance concerning German dispositions, they would have been aware of the presence of the panzers. As it was, there were a lot of casualties among the Allied troops. Then there's the story that François Mitterrand was a Vichyite. 1941, Mitterrand requested and received a decoration from Marshal Pétain. This fact has several times been raised during French political campaigns with the implication that Mitterrand was a collaborator during the war. Actually, Mitterrand, who held a position with Pétain's government as a supervisor of provisions for French troops held in German POW camps, was a clandestine agent for the resistance. At the time that Pétain announced he was decorating Mitterrand, Mitterrand was taking part in a secret conference of free French officials in London and had to hastily and secretly make his way back to France. Then there's Dieppe. And it was a massive raid. On August 19, 1942, 6,100 Canadian, 1,000 British, and several hundred American troops made a massive raid on the French coast near Dieppe. Resistance proved fierce, and by midday, the attackers were forced to withdraw after suffering tremendous casualties. Over 1,200 had been killed and 2,200 taken prisoner. Nearly 35 landing craft, 110 aircraft, 30 tanks were lost, along with extensive damage to other vessels and aircraft. German losses were about 300 dead and 300 wounded, and about 100 aircraft destroyed. Efforts have been made to depict the failure at Dieppe as a deliberate attempt by the British High Command to demonstrate the futility of a cross-channel attack to the American High Command, which was pressing for an early assault on German-occupied France. No evidence for such a cover-up can be found, but you know, if in fact that was the case, the evidence would have been, if not deeply buried, perhaps destroyed. Other theories put forth, especially in Canada, are the raid was simply a publicity stunt by the British leadership, and it was a morale-building exercise for the hard-pressed Russians who were constantly asking for that Western Second Front to take the pressure off of them. The raid continues to be a sore point with many Canadians who feel the British were being rather callous with the lives of the colonials, as they were called. The failure of the Dieppe raid was due to a combination of inadequate preparation and prompt intervention by the Luftwaffe, which was noticeably absent on D-Day 2 years later. Complicated by an unfortunate pre-dawn encounter between one of the approaching convoys of German coastal shipping, who alerted the defenders. Then there's another cover-up that's called the Other Losses cover-up. It contends that after the war, the Allies, specifically Eisenhower, conspired to deliberately starve to death more than 700,000 German prisoners of war. The evidence for this is an Other Losses entry in Allied POW records, following by the number 700,000. The contention is that this entry covers up hundreds of thousands of men who died as a result of being denied proper rations during the winter of 1945-46. Investigation has determined that about 90% of the men included in Other Losses were released from prisoner of war camps without formal discharge. Mostly they were old men and young boys dragooned into the German army in the closing days of the war and no particular threat to anybody. The balance of the men covered in the Other Losses entry included about 70,000 who died, many from wounds incurred before their capture from typhus or other disease contracted on the front, and some who were transferred to various countries to be dealt with as collaborators and war criminals. The evidence is available for the proponents of the conspiracy theory, if they'd simply look for it. Then we have Hitler plotted Stalin's purge. Now, the purge of the Red Army in the mid-1930s, during which Stalin shot most of his higher-ranking commanders, is generally regarded as having been one of the causes of the disasters that plagued the Soviet army in the opening months of the German invasion. A number of popular publications and writers have asserted that the purge was a result of a plot by German military intelligence to decapitate the Red Army. If, in fact, it was a brilliant move. Supposedly, information was leaked to the Soviet secret police that implicated many of the leading Soviet generals in a conspiracy to overthrow Stalin. Now, despite extensive investigation, no solid evidence has ever turned up to support this assertion, which appears to have been based on the imagination of some German middle-ranking intelligence personnel who wanted to ingratiate themselves with their allied interrogators after the war. In fact, Stalin... his paranoia was sufficient explanation for the purge, which was, after all, involved all segments of Soviet society, not merely the army. Then we have the conspiracy that many refer to as Winston Churchill's stand-in. It's been asserted that Churchill didn't make any of his famous radio addresses, but rather used an actor. And there is a little bit of truth to this, apparently, but only some. Most of Churchill's speeches before the House of Commons were recorded for later radio broadcast. However, his first speech as Prime Minister, the Blood, Toil, Tears, and Sweat address delivered to the House on May 13, 1940, was not recorded. And since Winston was rather busy at the time with trying to form a government while the Netherlands was surrendering, Belgium being overrun, and the French armies being broken by the German assault, an actor was asked to stand in for Churchill on the BBC. Well, it's sad this was done once. All of Churchill's other radio broadcasts are either live or pre-recorded. But it does raise interesting questions. If he had a stand-in who even sounded like him, that could explain a number of puzzles left over from the war. Then there's the story that the Holocaust never happened. Now, frankly, the evidence for the Holocaust having happened is so overwhelming, including, as it does, not merely enormous numbers of survivors, but equally large numbers of Allied troops who helped liberate the camps, and a mountain of German documents. Proponents of the notion it never happened have to be looked at with a little bit of suspicion. The biggest source of disbelief of the Holocaust is sheer ignorance among many people about history in general, and World War II in particular. American education in the past 20 or 30 years has de-emphasized the study of history. The result is that many younger educated Americans are woefully ignorant about details of American and world history. In fact, you'll find college-educated folks have only a vague idea what World War II was all about. Particularly true in the electronic media, where the producers, those who do the legwork of digging up material to be broadcast, are usually the products of this, lack of... real education in the education system. When they don't know, doesn't get broadcast or get sent over the air inaccurately. Well, by the end of the by the beginning of the Second World War, the battleship had been the primary arbiter of sea power for over 300 years, during which time it had grown and evolved into horrendously expensive, enormously powerful, and surprisingly vulnerable weapon system. It had come out of the First World War with its reputation largely intact. Of the scores of modern battleships that saw service in that war, only two were sunk, one by a mine planted by a submarine and the other by an internal explosion. The record of the two dozen so battle cruisers, which toted battleship artillery but sacrificed armor protection for speed, is a little less impressive. Four being lost in action, all to enemy gunfire. Well, this was a little surprising, since even the admirals of the age were perfectly aware their ships could be sunk and had worried for years about their vulnerability to torpedoes, whether launched by surface vessels or submarines. Of course, a few aviation enthusiasts argued the battleship was vulnerable to the airplane, but this was not a particularly convincing argument considering the capabilities of aircraft at the time. We're talking about the beginning of the war. Even the famous sinking of the German prize Ostfriesland by U.S. Army bombers July 21, 1921, wasn't considered a valid test, given that the trial had been rigged in favor of the airmen to begin with, and they were then cheated anyway. The test was conducted on a clear, calm day with the ship anchored in open water. Airmen coming in at such low levels that had the ship been shooting back, none of them would have survived. Most objective trials against other vessels, including far newer, although unfinished battleships whose completion was canceled by the disarmament treaties of the 1920, provided some really valuable clues as to the vulnerability of battleships. During the 20s and 30s, most navies still considered the battleship the principal arm of sea power. But the bigger ones, the Royal Navy, the Japanese Imperial Navy, and the U.S. Navy, also invested their money in aircraft carriers. Now, this was partially out of the belief the new weapon had potential. In addition, since the Washington and London Naval Disarmament Treaties of 22 and 1930 restricted the number of battleships, but not carriers, this made having some aircraft carriers around to provide billets for senior officers rather attractive. These navies began to debate the ways in which the future naval warfare would develop. Ultimately, they all came to assume that the battleship and the carrier were complementary of each other. In fleet actions, carrier aircraft could scout for the enemy and soften him up with air attacks. Then the battleship would go in and slug it out. And afterwards, the aircraft carrier aircraft would follow up victory by pursuing the fleeing enemy to sink damaged and disabled vessels, or to cover defeat by serving as the rear guard, attacking the pursuing foe to slow him down. Meanwhile, of course, bigger and better battleships were being built. Simply defined, the battleship is a very large, over 20,000-ton displacement, heavily armored warship toting eight or more very large guns. Now, these are 12-inch caliber or greater. By the mid-1930s, when large-scale battleship construction was resumed, the ships and guns were growing very large. 35,000 tons and 14-inch guns were considered minimal. They were also growing faster. Each generation of battleships had been quite slow, about 20 to 22 knots. The problem that had fostered the development of the battle cruiser, basically a battleship in which armor protection was sacrificed for larger, more powerful engines, which gave higher speeds. Battle cruiser hadn't worked out very well in combat, since its thin armor made it particularly vulnerable to a slugfest. And by the late 1930s, the surviving battle cruisers were even more obsolete than the older battleships. And just when they thought they had all the problems identified, along came World War II. Aircraft carrier took a while to establish itself as the primary warship. In fact, not until Pearl Harbor, when the war was already 2 years old in the Atlantic. But that didn't mean the battleship was a goner. In fact, battleships, whether the older, slower veterans of World War I or their new, speedier descendants, still played an important and varied role in the war. Battleships proved immensely valuable in helping to defend carriers, which are even more vulnerable than battleships, having virtually no armor, little organic offensive firepower, and carrying thousands of tons of highly inflammable aviation fuel from air attacks while protecting themselves. On one occasion, the South Dakota shot down several aircraft several dozen attacking aircraft in about 5 minutes. Their heavy guns were extremely useful in covering amphibious landings all over the world, with not a few landings being made considerably easier by the support of battleship gunfire. During the protracted ground struggle for Okinawa, for example, U.S. battleships and large cruisers expended 23,157 rounds of 16-inch, 14-inch, and 12-inch ammunition. The weight of metal alone was over 12,000 tons. And I don't care who you are, when that comes in, you hit the ground. And surprisingly, battleships still occasionally managed to slug it out the old-fashioned way. In fact, there were more battleship-to-battleship engagements in the war than there were carrier-to-carrier battles. There were 9 battleship-to-battleship engagements and only 5 carrier-to-carrier. April 9, 1940, the German battleships Gneisenau and Scharnhorst engaged the old British battlecruiser Renown in an indecisive action off Norway. On July 30, 1940, World War I vintage battleship, British battleship Resolution and Valiant, with the 1920 battlecruiser Hood, the largest and fastest major warship in the world at the time, and a few other ships attacked the French fleet at Oran in Algeria, destroying the even older battleship Britannia, severely damaging her sister ship Provence, and less seriously damaging the new Dunkirk, while the latter sister ship Strasbourg managed to escape unscathed. Or unscathed, I guess you could say. July 9, 1940, the Italian squadron, including the reconstructed old battleship Giulio Cesare and Conte di Cavour, was intercepted off Calabria by a British squadron, including the older battleship War Sprite, Royal Sovereign, in Malaya, in an often intense action of about 50 minutes, during which the Cesare suffered serious damage by a shot from the War Sprite, which holds the record for the longest range artillery hit on the high seas in naval history. It was about 26,000 yards. May 24, 1941, in a brief morning encounter with the new German battleship Bismarck and an escorting heavy cruiser in the Denmark Strait, the even newer British battleship Prince of Wales was damaged and the battlecruiser Hood blew up, leaving only 3 survivors. Later that afternoon, the Bismarck and the Prince of Wales briefly clashed again without ill effects on either one. May 27, 1941, after a wide-ranging chase across the Atlantic, the Bismarck, slowed by several fortuitous aerial torpedo hits, was finally brought to bay by the new battleship King George V and the older Rodney, which in nearly 3 hours fired about 700 major caliber rounds, not to mention hundreds of smaller stuff, from 2 supporting heavy cruisers, reducing the battleship to a burning wreck, which was finished off by several torpedoes. The fear was, if they didn't bring down the Bismarck, it would become a rogue wild card that very few ships were able to oppose. November 8, 1942, the new battleship Massachusetts exchanged several hundred rounds of heavy caliber shells with the partially completed French Jean Bart she was still fitting out, tied up to a dock in Casablanca. The latter was knocked out of action. November 14th and 15th, 1942, in a wild action that commenced shortly after midnight, a Japanese squadron, including the Kirishima, engaged the new Washington and South Dakota, with the latter taking considerable damage, but the former pounding the modernized Japanese battlecruiser so badly she had to be scuttled the next morning. December 26, 1943, off Cape Cod, off North Cape, northernmost part of Europe, a British squadron, including the new battleship Duke of York, encountered a German Scharnhorst, resulting in the latter sinking after protracted slugfest. October 24th, 25th, 1944, the U.S. squadron, including the refurbished old battleships Mississippi, Maryland, West Virginia, Tennessee, California, and Pennsylvania, all but the Mississippi had been at Pearl Harbor, supported by numerous smaller vessels, ambushed a Japanese force, including the old battleships Fuso and Yamashiro, which was annihilated in an action so one-sided the Pennsylvania never got a chance to fire. And that was the last time in history that battleships ever fired on each other.
Well, the Waffen-SS, the armed forces of the German Nazi Party, filled the majority of their nearly 40 combat divisions with non-Germans. It was considered Hitler's foreign legion. Over 500,000 foreigners served in 27 of these Waffen-SS divisions, as well as in many smaller independent units and as replacements for the horrendous losses the SS divisions took. The radical racial purity message of the Nazi Party got a bit garbled by the SS recruiters, as the largest single ethnic group enlisted was Slavic Ukrainians, about 100,000, followed by the Aryan Dutch, about 50,000. Three divisions were formed from among Bosnian Muslims and Croatian Christians, and like most non-German SS divisions, were used against partisans. So successful was this program that even the regular army regularly filled 20% of its divisions after 1943 with foreign volunteers. These were usually Soviet prisoners of war who were given the choice between starving to death in POW camps or serving as combat support troops in German military divisions. Well, most of these foreigners in German uniforms, especially the Soviets, were killed or imprisoned by their own countrymen after the war. Some days you just can't get a break. And as a result of an anti-vice drive conducted by Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, who was also the National Director of Civil Defense, the scrap from 3,252 slot and pinball machines confiscated in New York City during World War II was donated to the war effort. That included 3,000 pounds of ball bearings. And ball bearings were very difficult to get, let me tell you. As a wartime measure, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade was canceled in 1942, and the famous balloons were donated to the war effort, which yielded 650 pounds of scrap rubber. The general shortage of raw materials because of wartime needs caused massive recycling and rationing efforts worldwide. At the end of World War II, Britain had 19% of its total male population and 2% of its total female population under arms, in contrast to the U.S., where the corresponding figures were 14% of its males and less than 0.1% of its females. You know, the leader of one World War II nation was in many ways a New Age man, well before his time, neither smoking or drinking alcoholic beverages, confining himself to a vitamin-rich vegetarian diet, consulting his astrologer regularly, communing with the spiritual guardians of his people, and opposing animal experimentation and vivisection. Now, you might initially think this was a man who'd be right at home in modern-day California, but his name was actually Adolf Hitler. You know, enormous amounts of weapons and equipment was built during World War II, and we were the biggest producer. Worldwide, 542,000 aircraft, of which in the U.S., 283,000 were built here, 52%. Guns of all type, 45,300,000. 17.5 million was built here, 35%. Vehicles, 5,100,000. 2,470,000 was built here, or 48%. And ships in tons, 79 million worldwide, 54 million in the U.S., 68%. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back on Monday when we'll talk more about little-known facts of World War II. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for The Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great weekend.